This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this week we're on episode 46.
And we're coming to you with something a little bit different.
Kind of, yeah. It's like a cult that's not a cult.
Yeah, we don't know if it meets the definition of a cult or not, but it's really interesting.
It feels like a cult, right?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well,
we've determined that it is, in fact, a cult.
By no real determination, just that it feels like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you should definitely make logical decisions. but this week we are going to be covering the Branch Davidians and the shooting in Waco, Texas that resulted because of it. But before we get into all of that, what are you binging this week?
So this week I am binging another TV show.
Okay.
And I'd never seen it before, even though like it first came out in 2006.
Did it really?
Yeah.
I know what the binge is. I'm sorry, yeah. Guys.
I was in the sixth grade.
Like, wow.
But I am binging the TV show Dexter.
Finally.
I know. I'm like halfway through season two right now, and there's eight seasons, and I'm just like ready for it. I love Dexter.
When you get to the final episode, let me know how you feel. Thoughts, feelings, feel free to text me in all caps, crying, whatever you'd like. Dexter is like one of those shows that was really good and then just like, what'd you do at the ending, my guy?
Yeah. So like probably they didn't know they were ending and it just kind of like shit the bed.
No, they definitely planned like
ooh.
The ending is clearly thought out, but it's just not good.
Okay.
But makes sense. It's still a really good show. Like I liked the show when I watched it. I was just like that. Ending though,
yeah, because I like in the first season I was like, oh, that's the killer.
Yeah,
and like it's kind of predictable, but I still is really good.
Yeah, it's like a fun show. I haven't watched it in a couple of years, but I liked it when I saw it, so yeah, it's a fun one.
Yeah,
and it's about killers, so
exactly, it kind of goes with the theme of our lives.
Yeah, except it's a serial killer who's conflicted and doesn't know what he should do about his killing tendencies, so he kills people.
Yeah, he's only killing the bad people, Morgan.
Yeah.
But what is your binge?
My binge is kind of related.
Okay.
Mine is Tiger King on Netflix, which covers the case of Joe Exotic, who is a Florida man partially.
Okay.
Like when his crimes take place, he's in Florida, but I believe he's originally from like Oklahoma City.
Makes sense.
He's like a Florida man in his heart. But this is a case like about a guy who plots the murder of an animal rights activist who is like coming against him saying what he's doing is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. I've been following the case only because of last podcast, because they've been covering it. And I firmly believe in my heart that they are the reason why this documentary got made. And I know it's not, but in my heart, that's why it's gotten made. But it's just a super crazy case. And it's out right now. If you're still in your homes because of Corona, then give it a watch. There's so many things to watch on Netflix. And this is just the new true crime thing that Netflix has put out.
Yeah, I saw the like trailer for it.
Yeah.
But I have not gotten into it yet. But it looked crazy and a ton of people that I know have watched it.
Yeah.
And they're like, what the fuck?
Oh yeah, no, it's insane. And like what I've learned is that people who are like big cat people mm-hmm. are insane.
Okay.
That's what I've learned from watching it, is that they're all crazy. Like, even the right animal rights activist
yeah.
who, like, is against Joe Exotic, she has an animal rescue that takes in big cats that,
oh.
like, need to be surrendered. And it's just, it's really interesting. You should watch it. I don't want to give away the whole thing, but it's very strange.
Well, we do have a the Big Cat Habitat here in
Sarasota. We do have the Big Cat Habitat. And I painted their monkey cage when I was a church going girl.
I have never been there.
Really?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay.
Like, it takes you all of 20 minutes to see everything they have, pretty much. So it's not like a huge
thing. It's not like a zoo.
Yeah, because it's a habitat.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That was so stupid. But yeah, it's basically the same thing where it's like a rescue type thing.
Makes
and then
sense.
They make their money by you paying to come see it. But
okay.
It's just, it's a really interesting thing, you know? I feel like you didn't talk about Dexter that much. Do you want to talk about Dexter more?
I mean, I'm
I feel
fine.
Like I took over talking about Dexter for you.
I mean, I feel like if people don't know who Dexter is, then they're wrong.
All right. Well,
I said when it started and that it had 8 seasons.
Okay.
And
that's fine.
I read the IMDb page.
But before we get into everything, yes, Corona is still happening. I should probably stop calling it Corona.
It's COVID-19.
Yeah, that's probably the better way to refer to it. Makes it sound more serious, which it is.
Which, I don't know why, when people just call it Corona instead of like coronavirus or COVID-19, it reminds me of just like a really bitchy teenage girl.
You're not wrong. Like a teenage girl with an attitude problem.
Yeah, it's like Corona won't let me leave the house.
Yeah, it feels like a casual name to call it, you know? Instead of being all serious. You know the app Nextdoor?
Yes.
I'm a part of it, and I got a post today that was like, is anyone going on walks with their cat? Has anyone considered that their cats also want out of the house? And I was like, cats are always in the house, so this happening doesn't affect them at all. Okay. I just saw a man walking his dog, which triggered that thought in my head.
But didn't you buy a harness to try and walk your cat once?
Yeah, and I still stand by it. I'm just saying it was a weird thought that was put out because they were like, should I start walking my cat, basically? And it's like, did you ever walk your cat before this?
Okay.
You know what I mean?
That makes more sense.
Yeah. They were just like asking, should we be taking our cats for walks? And I'm like, have you ever taken your cat for a walk?
I mean, I used to be friends with someone who walked their rabbit.
I think Azula would love walking on the leash because she likes the world. But she's also like scared of everything.
Yeah.
So I think that if she ever saw a dog not behind a screen, she would lose her shit and slip out of the harness.
Yeah, I mean, like, my dog is afraid of everything, and he's now 65 pounds, and so he's a lot worse to handle, and he just takes off running. He saw a boat the other day.
Yeah.
And he is afraid of boats, apparently, because he just took off running in the opposite direction towards our apartment.
He does not want anything to do with that boat.
He doesn't. And I was like, dang, I was gonna try and take him on a boat one day.
Eventually.
I'm rich enough to have a boat.
Yeah, that'll definitely happen.
Yeah, right.
So this week we are covering the Branch Davidians and the siege of their compound in Waco, Texas. This simple raid turned siege ended up lasting for 51 days and resulted in the deaths of 16 ATF agents and 82 Branch Davidians, including their leader, David Koresh.
So now we're going to back up a little bit and talk about who the Branch Davidians are and kind of their history for a little bit.
You got to get a little background info.
Exactly. So we start with Victor Hutev. He was a Bulgarian immigrant and a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And he was a Seventh-day Adventist Sabbath school teacher in Southern California.
To be fair, that's a hard sentence to say.
Seventh-day Sabbath.
Yeah.
Is very
Wait,
difficult.
No, you have to say Seventh-day Sabbath school teacher.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of S's.
It is. So, Victor joined the church in 1919, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a Protestant Christian denomination, which is distinguished by its observance of Saturday, the seventh day of the week, as the Sabbath, and its emphasis on the imminent second coming of Jesus Christ. I know nothing about religion, so like I felt like we should add in a little bit about who the Seventh-day Adventists
are. I know nothing about who the Seventh-day Adventists are, so I appreciate that.
Okay.
Because I had no idea. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Story checks out, but I had no idea.
So in 1929, 10 years after joining the church, Victor Hutef came into a conflict with the church's authorities over differing interpretations of chapters 54 through 66 in the book of Isaiah.
Here's the thing. That is such a small amount of text
out of
the entire Bible.
Yeah.
Like, that's so interesting to me. It just seems like it's very oddly specific.
Mm-hmm. So he believed that the church was becoming too relaxed with its standards and it needed to be reformed. He taught this idea in his Sabbath school lessons, in which, when church members complained, the authorities determined that his interpretations were not compatible with Adventist theology. In the summer of 1930, he compiled his ideas into a book called The Shepherd's Rod, the 144,000 to A Call for Reformation.
Interesting.
In November 1930, he was disfellowshipped as well as his followers by the local Seventh-day Adventist congregation, quote, for the protection of the church.
Hmm.
In 1934, Victor moved to Texas and established a headquarters to the west of Waco, Texas, and his group was named the Davidians. In 1942, Victor renamed the group, don't know why, but he renamed it to the General Association of Davidian Seventh-day Adventists.
I feel like he thought the longer the title, the more official it sounded.
Yeah, and also maybe trying to reconnect with Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah, like maybe draw that crowd into what he was talking about.
But Davidian meant the belief in the restoration of the Davidic?
Yeah.
Of the Davidic kingdom of Israel. And his people lived a simple life and they avoided commercial forms of entertainment. The community was hardworking and eventually became self-sustaining. The literature studied by them circulated to a growing group of believers across the whole country.
Wow. I mean, I guess that's really how any religion starts.
But
time I hear it, I'm like, wow, that's so interesting.
It's like how a podcast starts, like just your friends listen to it at first. And then everyone else like kind of trickles in.
Eventually, maybe. Everyone else, our 5,000 listeners.
Hey.
That's pretty impressive.
I love our 5,000 listeners.
I do too. I'm just saying. We are by no means.
Oh, no. We're not big at all.
Oh, no, no, no.
We don't have a big following. We're not great cult leaders. We're just...
We're okay cult leaders. Control yourself, Morgan. I know you haven't seen Sarah in a week, but you can handle this.
I feel like we should have premised that at the top of the show.
I meant to, actually. I just... My brain is so I don't know what I was going to say. Discombobulated. But yeah, Sarah and I haven't seen each other in over a week because... Not really.
A week
today. A week, exactly.
Yeah.
So
we're talkative.
Yeah, we're very talkative. We haven't seen each other and we see each other pretty much every single day. So this is new for us.
It is.
Yeah. Victor died in 1955 and his wife Florence took over as the leader. Florence was convinced that an apocalypse was coming and gave the followers a time frame in which it was going to happen. This is never a good idea as a cult leader, I should just say.
Never give a time frame.
Yeah, like it ruins things. So she set a date of April 22nd, 1959, as the dawn of the new Masonic age. She led the hundreds of followers and gathered them all together at the Mount Carmel Center near Waco in 1959. Many followers built houses. Others even stayed in tents, trucks, or buses and most of these people sold all of their earthly possessions. After the events Florence spoke of and the apocalypse didn't happen within her time frame, some of the members were disappointed with her and left the group.
I'd be pissed if I sold all my shit.
Oh, yeah. And then like, it didn't happen.
Yeah, I would beat her up.
Start a fist fight with Florence.
A swift kick in the face. Sorry, that was aggressive.
You're fine. The tiny kick you did with your foot indicated it wouldn't actually be aggressive in any way.
It's like when I fake punch my boyfriend and like it wouldn't even hurt a fly the yeah. way I punch him.
One time what was I doing? Oh, I was trying to push Taylor like away, like with my feet and arms, and he's like, "You're so weak, it's incredible." It's like, God damn it, leave me alone. One of the members, Benjamin Roden, formed another group and took control over Mount Carmel in 1962. This group was simply called the Branch Davidians.
I like it.
Simple. He called his members to appear alive and promised that Christ would return soon after the members reached a state of moral maturity. And Benjamin Roden actually eventually died in 1978. His members were torn between allegiance to his wife, Lois, and his son, George. In 1981, a man named Vernon Howell, later David Koresh, arrived at the compound.
So now, because if you've heard of this case, you know that David Koresh is a big person in this.
Right.
We're going to give a little bit of his background. So he was born Vernon Howell on April 17th, 1959, in Houston, Texas, to a 14-year-old single mother named Bonnie Sue Clark. His father's name was Bobby Wayne Howell, but left before Koresh was even born to date another teenage girl.
And
he was 19 and she was 14.
Yeah.
So not great. Not terrible, but not great.
Not ideal. I believe at the time, legally speaking, the age of consent was 14 in the state of Texas. So legally, it was okay, I think, but it's still not good.
Yeah, and regardless. I feel like 14-year-olds shouldn't be having babies regardless because they're still babies themselves.
Yeah.
Anyways, his mother began living with another man who was a violent alcoholic. In 1963, his mother left with her boyfriend and gave her 4-year-old son to his maternal grandmother, Earlene Clark. His mom returned when he was 7 after she was married to a carpenter named Roy Haldeman. Bonnie and Roy had a child together named Roger in 1966, so he had like a little brother. When Koresh was 19, he had a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old who then got pregnant.
Sounds like he's reliving his parents' life.
Right? He claimed that he was a born-again Christian and soon joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Here, he became infatuated with the pastor's daughter, and while praying for guidance on this issue, he allegedly opened his eyes and found the Bible open at
Isaiah
34:16, none should want for her mate. Convinced that this was a sign from God, he approached the pastor and told him that God wanted his daughter to be his wife. The pastor threw him out, and when he still tried to go after the daughter, he was kicked out of the church entirely.
Yeah, the pastor was just like, that's going to be a hard no for me.
So, at the age of 22, Vernon Howell moved to Waco, Texas, where he then joined the Branch Davidians.
And his arrival was actually pretty well received by nearly everyone at the Davidian commune. But he began having an affair with the then prophet Benjamin's wife, Lois Roden.
But this was after Benjamin had died.
Right. Vernon was in his late 20s and Lois was in her late 60s at the time.
So she was a cougar.
I don't know if it was really
her. Who seduced who?
Yeah. I feel like Cougar implies that she seduced him, and it feels like David was just out here trying to
sleep his way to the top.
Yeah, basically. Vernon wanted to have a child with her, and he believed that it would be the chosen one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously.
For sure-sies. And Lois allowed Vernon to teach his own message, which was called the Serpent's Root, which did cause some controversy in the group. After Lois died, her son George Roden inherited the position of prophet and leader of the commune. See, I think when you start using terms like prophet is why I think it's a cult in my head.
Yeah.
You know what
like,
I mean?
I am the one.
Yeah, like I'm the prophet. I'm the one who's speaking to God. And like, that's just what gives me culty vibes. Vernon announced that God had instructed him to marry Rachel Jones. And after they were married, there was a short period of peace at Mount Carmel. But George Roden and Vernon Howell began to butt heads, and Vernon began to receive the loyalty of the majority of the Branch Davidian community. In 1984, a meeting led to the division of the group, with George leading one faction and Vernon leading the other. After this, George ran Vernon and his followers off of Mount Carmel at gunpoint, and Vernon relocated his group to Palestine, Texas, which I believe is actually pronounced Palestine, Texas, in that specific area, even though it's definitely Palestine. George Roden gave Vernon a challenge in order to regain support in the community. He challenged him to raise someone from the dead, thinking whoever could do it would obviously have to be the prophet. And George went out and actually dug up the body of a woman named Anna Hughes from the Davidian Cemetery. And because of this, I think that Vernon was smart.
Oh, yeah.
Vernon knew he could not raise someone from the dead. So he went out and attempted to file charges on George, saying he's going to dig up this dead body, but was told that he needed evidence that the illegal activity was actually happening.
So, on November 3rd, 1987, Vernon, with seven of his followers, raided the Mount Carmel Center with an attempt to photograph the body in the casket as evidence. They were armed with five 223 caliber semi-automatic rifles, two 22 caliber rifles, two 12-gauge shotguns, and over 400 rounds of ammunition. The one thing they were not armed with was a camera, though, to take pictures of the body.
Oh, that would help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is said that they like did the raid as an excuse to get pictures right. of the body, but like really to overtake their land again.
Okay. Makes sense.
But George Roden was informed of the impending raid and opened fire on them when they arrived. The police arrived within 20 minutes to this gunfight, and Sheriff Harwell got Vernon on the phone and told them to stop shooting and surrender, which they did. George Roden was injured in the fight, but it was minor.
Yeah.
Vernon and his followers were dubbed the Rodenville Eight by the media, and they were all charged with attempted murder. In their trial, on April 12, 1988, seven people were acquitted, but the jury was hung on Vernon's verdict. But the county prosecutors didn't press the case any further, and a mistrial was called. After the charges were dropped, Vernon invited the prosecutors to Mount Carmel for ice cream.
Same.
Like, not his defense attorneys, but the prosecutors.
He was probably just trying to, like, make friends with the local police and, like, lawyers and stuff.
Very true.
Because he knew he was going to be in some type of trouble.
Right.
So George was still charged for the crime of corpse abuse, and when the defense attorney tried to bring the casket in, the judge said that the courtroom is no place for a casket, which, like, is a valid point.
Yeah.
He admitted to attempting to resurrect Anne Hughes on three occasions. Upon waiting for trial, George was put in jail for contempt of court for foul language. He also threatened the Texas court with sexually transmitted diseases if the court ruled in Vernon's favor. And George actually ended up spending 6 months in jail. And then later 90 days when he was found living on the property of Mount Carmel when he was not supposed to. So later in 1989, George was found guilty by order of insanity for killing a Davidian with an axe after a conversation they had, and he was committed to a mental institution. After George was committed, Vernon raised enough money to pay off all of the back taxes that were owed on the property and took legal control of Mount Carmel, and his followers went back to living there. On August 5th, 1989, Vernon released an audio tape called New Light. In this tape, he claimed to have been told by God that he had to procreate with the women of the group to establish a House of David and to start building an army for God to prepare for the end of days. This meant that Vernon started separating married couples and that they had to agree that Vernon was allowed to have sexual relations with the wives and the men were to practice celibacy. I feel like this is also always the start of a cult.
Oh, yeah.
Like the it's sexual
like you
thing.
You can't fuck your wife, but I can fuck your wife.
His doctrine of the House of David did lead to marriages with both single and married women in the group, including underage girls, some of which were as young as 12 years old.
And that's when it got real culty because it turned into, I can also fuck your daughter.
Yeah, and I can marry your daughter.
Yeah.
One girl was Michelle Jones, the younger sister of his legal wife, Rachel, and the daughter of lifelong Branch Davidians, Perry and Mary Bell Jones. He also announced that he was entitled to at least 140 wives within the group.
On May 15th, 1990, Vernon Howell filed a petition in California State Superior Court in
Pomona,
thank you.
You're welcome.
To legally change his name to David Koresh, which I'm confused because they all lived in Texas. Why did he go to California to do it?
Don't know. Couldn't tell you.
Because I was maybe this is wrong. And I looked it up in four different sources still said California.
Yeah. So, I know that he legally changed his name, but that's all I know is that he did everything by the book so he couldn't get in trouble. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
So he said that he changed his name for publicity and business purposes.
I mean, it's better if you lead the Davidians and your name is David.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Story right. Checks out again.
So, on August 28th, 1990, Judge Robert Martinez granted the petition. And a little bit about the name. Koresh is the biblical name of Cyrus the Great, who was a Persian king called a Messiah for freeing Jews. David symbolized a lineage directly from biblical King David, from whom the new Messiah would descend. By taking the name David Koresh, he was professing himself to be the spiritual descendant of King David, a messianic figure carrying out a divinely commissioned errand.
Very fancy stuff.
Oh, yeah. But in 1992, there was a 6-month investigation of child abuse allegations by the Texas Child Protection Services. This failed to turn up any evidence, most likely because the members of the group concealed Koresh's spiritual marriage to Michelle Jones, and they actually assigned her a surrogate husband for the sake of appearances. And they were like, oh no, that's her real husband. She's still underage. Why does she have a husband? But whatever.
Yeah, that's a very... Also, anytime you're saying a spiritual marriage, you're not fucking married.
No.
You're not really married at all.
They're married in the heart. They're married in the eyes of God, Morgan. It is said that Koresh fathered at least 14 children by different women in the group, and some of them were with underage girls. Once he became so angry when one of his sons, Cyrus, was crying that he spanked the child severely for several minutes on 3 consecutive visits to the child's bedroom. In another report, a man involved in a custody battle visited the Mount Carmel Center and claimed to have seen the beating of a young boy with a stick. So not great.
You gotta hit your kids. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. I'm honestly shocked that, there was a custody battle in Texas where people are he was beating him with the stick. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I feel like in Texas during that time especially, they were like, fucking smack your kid across the face with a tree branch if they did something wrong.
Yeah, like, it was like the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Like, people were still
spanking
their kids.
Yeah. On February 27th, 1993, the Waco Tribune Herald began publishing The Sinful Messiah, which is just such a cool name.
Mm-hmm.
The Sinful Messiah was a series of articles written by Mark England and Darlene McCormick, who reported allegations that Koresh had physically abused children in the compound and had committed statutory rape by taking multiple underage brides.
Not wrong.
Yeah. It was also said that he advocated polygamy for himself and declared himself married to several of the female residents of the small community. Also true. The paper claimed that Koresh had announced he was entitled to at least 140 wives and that he was entitled to claim any of the women in the group as his own. And they also claimed that he fathered at least a dozen children and that some of these mothers became brides as young as 12 or 13. But this is like the public finding out about this information for the first time. Along with these claims, there were also rumors that they were suspected of stockpiling illegal weapons at the compound, which turns out is not true. All of the weapons they had were legally obtained.
Yes, they were legally obtained.
Yes. So they weren't like illegal weapons, which is what the implication was, but it was the stockpiling of them.
Yeah. And I think they thought that they were like changing them to make them like
modify them.
Yes.
See, when I was like researching it, like I found out that the Davidians were actually selling them.
Oh.
Like, they were legally obtaining and legally selling the guns to other people. So I don't know how true that is. Because this case is so controversial.
Yeah, and
I
no
guess
one really
term.
Knows what happens because the FBI says one thing and the Branch Davidians say
something
say another.
Else. Yeah, like, it's just really weird. Back in May of 1992, Chief Deputy Daniel Weyenberg from the McLennan County Sheriff's Department called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to notify them that his office had been contacted by a local UPS representative concerned about a report by a local driver. This UPS driver said a package had been broken open on delivery to the Branch Davidian residence, revealing firearms, inert grenade casings, and black powder.
Which, like, I'm proud of this UPS driver. It's like, see something, say something.
Yeah, but also, how did the package break open enough on delivery that you saw all of those things?
I mean, it probably broke open a little
and
bit.
And he was like, is that a gun?
Yeah, that's probably what happened.
Me as fuck, by the way.
Do you remember when we worked at Michael's and some of the boxes just ripped open?
Yeah.
And like, there was a lawnmower blade in our like frame box.
No.
Yeah, that happened.
I don't remember that at all.
There was like a piece of a lawnmower in the box because like two or three different boxes opened up and they just shoved shit inside of wherever.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't recall that at all. Wow, I really blocked that time out. On June 9th, the ATF opened a formal investigation, and after a week, it was classified as a high degree of oversight from the Houston headquarters. There were reports that the ATF had also received reports of gunfire coming from the compound without looking into it.
On July 30th, ATF agents David Aguilera and Skinner visited the Branch Davidians' gun dealer, Henry McMahon, who tried to get them to talk with Koresh on the phone. Koresh offered to let the ATF inspect the Branch Davidians' weapons and paperwork and asked to speak with Aguilera, but he declined.
So, like, to me, it seems like they were doing what they were supposed to on the Branch Davidians' end, and, like, the ATF was just not dealing with it.
Yeah, they were like, no, we just want to take all your weapons.
Yeah.
The ATF began surveillance from a house across the road from the compound several months before the siege actually happened. Their cover wasn't a great one because they posed as college students, but like they were all in their 30s. They all had new cars. They weren't registered at local schools. And like they didn't keep a schedule that would fit like any real employment or class schedule.
It's kind of like when you watch High School Musical and realize all of the actors are in their 20s.
Yes. The ATF obtained a search warrant on suspicion that the Davidians were modifying guns to have illegal automatic fire capability. The ATF believed that the community had nearly 250 weapons, including semi-automatic rifles, assault rifles, shotguns, revolvers, pistols, and hundreds of grenades, which are like the scariest thing to me.
Yeah, grenades are very spooky. The ATF attempted to execute a search warrant at 9:45 a.m. on February 28th, 1993. Shit's about to get crazy, y'all. The warrant was related to alleged sexual abuse charges and illegal weapons violations, and they were attempting to just arrest David Koresh pretty much at this point. In broadcast afterwards, the local sheriff said he was not notified the raid was going to happen beforehand, which feels important that the local sheriff should know that there's a raid going down in their area. Despite knowing the Branch Davidians knew the raid was coming, the ATF commander ordered it to go ahead even though their plan depended on reaching the compound without the Branch Davidians being armed and prepared.
Which is so stupid, like wait another 2 weeks or something like that when they're not suspecting it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I think everything at this point is kind of on the ATF. Like, yeah. Because of the way that they're handling the situation. The ATF agents had their blood type written on their arms or neck after leaving the staging area before the raid. And this is actually not a standard procedure for the ATF, but it was recommended by the military. So they're showing beforehand that they're worried this is going to end poorly.
Yeah. And I didn't know that was a thing that, like, the military did or anything like that.
Me either. It's like when you write your kid's phone number, like, on their arm or stomach when you go to Disney so they don't get lost type thing. But I don't remember where I saw this, but apparently the ATF thought that this raid, like, was going to end in 20 minutes.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Like, they thought they were going to be in and out in 20 minutes.
Well, that's... I mean, if they're like, doing all this preparation, then that's obviously not going to happen.
It doesn't, like, with the preparations that they did, it just doesn't seem like they genuinely thought it was only going to take 20 minutes. Because like, that's what their report said.
I feel like that's what they just told, like,
the all members. Of the people.
Yeah. And, like, all the leaders were like, just kidding. It's going to take 51 days.
Yeah. So... even though there wasn't really any surprise to them doing the raid, even more advantage was lost when a KWTX TV reporter had been tipped off about the raid and asked for directions to the compound from a mail carrier who was also Koresh's brother-in-law. Like, what? What are the chances that that happened? Inside the compound, after hearing this news, Koresh told this fucking part, man. Koresh told undercover ATF agent Robert Rodriguez, who had infiltrated the Branch Davidians, that he knew a raid was imminent. The agent was astounded that his cover had been blown, and he made an excuse and just pieced out of the fucking compound.
Which I don't think that David Koresh knew that he was undercover. He was just like making conversation, being like, yeah, a raid is coming, prepare. And the guy was like, fuck, I'm found out.
Yeah,
I'm
he was out. Like, I gotta go. Abort, abort. All I picture is him dressed up like the guy from 30 Rock who's like, hello, fellow children. When this agent was interviewed later, he was asked what the Branch Davidians were doing but when he left the compound, and he simply responded that they were praying. Survivors of the events at Waco also said that Koresh ordered selected male followers to begin arming themselves and taking up defensive positions, while the women and children were told to take cover in their rooms. He told them he would try to speak to the agents, and what happened next would depend on the agents' intentions. So, from like what David thought was happening and what the Branch Davidians thought was happening is that the ATF was coming to shoot them up, basically.
Yeah.
And that's why they were arming themselves to protect themselves. And that's basically what ended up happening by accident.
Mm-hmm. When the ATF showed up, they heard shots coming from within the compound, while Branch Davidian survivors
We're both on a struggle bus tonight. It's because we haven't really talked to anybody.
I know. While Branch Davidian survivors claimed that the first shots came from the ATF agents outside. A reason that was suggested is that there was an accidental discharge of a weapon, possibly by an ATF agent, causing the ATF team to respond with fire from their automatic weapons. Other claims say that the first shots were fired by the ATF dog team sent to kill the dogs in the compound's kennel, which is the saddest thing I've ever read. Three helicopters from the Army National Guard were used as aerial distraction, and all of them ended up taking incoming fire. After taking fire, the helicopters immediately stopped their mission and landed, thankfully without any injuries.
Yeah.
Because helicopter injuries, like crashes and stuff, that's intense.
Yeah, that is.
During the first shots, Koresh was actually wounded. He was shot in the hand and in the stomach. Within a minute of the raid starting, Branch Davidian member Wayne Martin called emergency services, begging them to stop shooting. The recording of their call can hear the man screaming, "Here they come again!" and "That's them shooting! That's not us!" The ATF attempted to breach the compound for about 2 hours before their ammunition began running low.
And I read that their ammunition was actually low by about minute 45.
Wow.
And then they still continued to try and breach the compound for like the rest of that hour and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Agents also used ladders to get onto the roof of the building with hopes of reaching Koresh's room and the arms storage, but they were met with gunfire when trying to get inside. During this first attempt at the raid, four ATF agents were killed: Steve Willis, Robert Williams, Todd McKeon, and Conway Charles LeBlue. And another 16 were injured. There were five members of the Branch Davidians who ended up dying during this attempt, and they were Winston Blake, Peter Gent, Peter Hipspin, Perry Jones, and Jaden Wendell. Two of these people died at the hands of the Branch Davidians themselves, and their remains were buried on the ground of the compound.
Apparently, like, they got injured during the battle, and they either asked to be taken out or something
were
happened.
Taken out. Yeah.
Yeah. But supposedly they were injured beforehand. So Sheriff Lieutenant Lynch contacted the ATF and negotiated a ceasefire. After the ceasefire, the Branch Davidians allowed the ATF, dead and wounded, to be evacuated and held their fire during the ATF's retreat. Nearly 6 hours after the 11:30 a.m. ceasefire, Michael Schroeder was shot dead by ATF agents who alleged he fired a pistol at them as he attempted to re-enter the compound with Woodrow Kendrick and Norman Allison. A report later stated that the Branch Davidians did not ambush the ATF. ATF agents established contact with Koresh inside the compound after they withdrew, and the FBI took command soon after as a result of the death of federal agents. And Jeff Jamar was the site commander, and I feel like site commander is a fun term, so I just wanted to include that as literally the whole reason that's in there. The FBI hostage rescue team was headed by a man named Richard Rogers, who had actually already been criticized for his actions during the Ruby Ridge incident. And this was another incident of a family having guns and the ATF coming in and trying to get them. And it ended poorly. It ended up in another shootout. He would often override the site commander's wishes and created a situation which ultimately created more pressure at the current situation because he just wanted to be in charge and he wasn't. It was the site commander who was in charge.
I just rolled my eyes so far back.
In the beginning of the standoff, Koresh would be in contact with local media giving phone interviews like all the time. But the FBI cut their communication to the outside world real quick because the Branch Davidians were begging to be let go free without any more, like, fire. So, for the next 51 days, communication with those inside was done by telephone with a group of 25 FBI negotiators. Later, in the final justice report, it was found that these negotiators actually undercut a lot of the negotiations and they're just like, they weren't doing their job essentially.
Which is not great.
Not great for a situation like this where there is 90 people inside.
At first, the FBI believed that they may have made a breakthrough when they negotiated with Koresh an agreement that the Branch Davidians would peacefully leave the compound in return for a message that was recorded by Koresh and would be broadcasted on national radio. This broadcast was made, but then Koresh told the negotiators that God had told him to remain in the building and wait. Despite this revelation, negotiators were able to get 19 children released, ranging in age from 5 months to 12 years old, without their parents. Even with this release, there were still about 98 people left inside of the compound.
Yeah.
The children who were released were interviewed by the FBI and Texas Rangers for hours at a time. Allegedly, the children had been physically and sexually abused before the standoff. This was the key justification offered by the FBI for launching tear gas attacks to force the Davidians off the compound. During the standoff, the FBI sent in a video camera where Koresh introduced his children and his wives to the negotiators. Several of them were minors who claimed to have children that were fathered by Koresh. Several other members of the Davidians also made statements in the video. On day 9, Monday, March 8th, the Davidians sent the videotape out to the FBI to show that there were no hostages and that everyone inside was staying there on their own free will. The video also included a message from Koresh himself. The negotiator's log showed that after the tape had been reviewed, there was concern that the tapes released to the media would actually gain sympathy for the group. As the siege continued, Koresh negotiated more time, allegedly so that he could write religious documents, which he said he needed to complete before he surrendered.
Aggressive techniques were used by the FBI to try and force the Branch Davidians out and surrender. They used sleep deprivation techniques by playing loud sounds of jets, music, chanting, and the screams of rabbits being slaughtered, which is just so casual.
That made me so uncomfortable. I was like, specifically rabbits, like, just so specific.
I wonder, because I know there is an animal that when it screams sounds like a human almost.
Oh.
But I thought that was rats.
I don't know.
But that's also a technique often used by cult leaders to get their cultists to fall in line by using sleep deprivation. So it's interesting that the ATF and FBI are also using that. Armored vehicles would patrol the grounds and eventually ended up breaking down the perimeter fences and crushing cars that belonged to the Davidians. And they also drove over grave sites belonging to the Davidians as well.
So they were just like disrespecting them.
Yeah, that just feels rude at that point. They also cut all power and water off to the compound, forcing the members to survive on rainwater and MRE rations. Because of these attacks, Koresh ordered 11 people to surrender and leave the compound, who were all arrested as material witnesses. The children of the compound were aware that if they left, they were immediately separated from the women who went with them, and the women would be arrested. So they wanted to stay because they wanted to be with their moms.
Exactly.
Some religious scholars outside of the group attempted to persuade the FBI that their methods would only further reinforce the impression to the Davidians that they were a part of the biblical end times, end of times confrontation that they were willing to die for. The negotiation team kept trying to talk with Koresh, but the conversations became increasingly difficult as Koresh began saying that he was the second coming of Christ and was commanded by God to stay in the compound. And I feel like that just proves the last point is like, the longer he's here, the more and more his delusion is going to grow that he is actually the second Christ. And like,
yeah,
this is his hill he's literally going to die on. Like, it's crazy.
The FBI had actually considered killing Koresh and other high-ranking members via snipers, but they thought that this might result in a mass suicide by the rest of the members, similar to what happened at Jonestown.
Right.
But Koresh had later denied any idea of mass suicide, and this was confirmed by the members who surrendered and left the compound. Nearing the 51-day mark, President, at the time, Bill Clinton and newly appointed U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno discussed different ways to end the siege. Janet Reno wanted to mount an assault after hearing that the conditions inside the compound were bad and the children were being abused. President Clinton wanted to perform similar tactics used in the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord siege in Arkansas that happened in April 1985, where no lives were lost by using a blockade for as long as possible.
Also, the longest name of a siege ever.
Yes.
But a really cool name of a siege. Sorry.
But after Janet argued that their team was tired of waiting and the standoff was costing $1 million a week with the chance of child abuse and mass suicide, Clinton told her that, quote, if she thought that it was the right thing to do, she could go ahead.
So, on April 19th, 1993, the final assault by the FBI took place. They used combat engineering vehicles armed with explosives to punch holes in the walls of the building of the compound in order to pump in tear gas to force the members out without harming them. The plan was to use increasing amounts of gas over a period of 2 days to increase pressure. Loudspeakers were used in order to tell the members that there would be no armed assault and to ask them not to fire on them or their vehicles. The hostage rescue team had been permitted to return any incoming fire, but there were no shots fired by them. And when the Branch Davidians began firing at them, they only increased the amount of tear gas being used. Very early the next morning, the FBI hostage team started firing from grenade launchers and rounds of tear gas to try to draw the Branch Davidians out. After more than 6 hours, none of them had left, and they were all in an underground concrete shelter or using masks.
Yeah, like gas masks.
Yeah.
Around noon, 3 fires broke out almost simultaneously in different parts of the building. And the media was actually there to capture the building engulfing into flames. The government says that the fires were deliberately started by the Branch Davidians, where the Branch Davidians said that the fires were accidentally or deliberately started by the assault from the FBI. While the building was on fire, only 9 people ended up leaving. The remaining members, including women and children, were buried alive by rubble, suffocated, burned, or even shot by their own people. And this was kind of like mercy killings in order to die quicker and less painful than death by fire.
Yeah.
Steve Schneider, who was Koresh's top aide, allegedly shot and killed Koresh before shooting himself. In all, 76 people died during the fire this day. A large number of bodies were found in the bunker along with weapons and ammunition. And an independent investigation stated that the compound residents actually had enough time to escape if they had wanted to. At least 20 of the Branch Davidians had been shot, including 5 children under the age of 14, and a 3-year-old boy was stabbed to death in the chest. During the 51-day standoff, the FBI was able to secure the release of 44 people, and Koresh had 117 conversations with FBI negotiators that lasted a total of 60 hours.
So, the aftermath, because that was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, David Koresh is buried at Memorial Park Cemetery in Tyler, Texas, in the Last Supper section, which is interesting that they have a Last Supper section.
Right? I guess it's maybe like a prophet section.
That's what it sounds like. That's so strange.
Yeah. Maybe like religious leaders or something.
Yeah. And after his death, several of his albums ended up being released, including The Voice of Fire in 1994. In 2004, Koresh's 1968 Chevrolet Camaro, which had been damaged during the raid, sold for $37,000 at an auction, which is now owned by Ghost Adventures host Zach Baggins, because of course it is.
Yes,
he owns so much dumb shit.
I was like, I have to put it in there. But doesn't he own Ted Bundy's car too? Because that one's pretty cool.
I don't know. I know he just recently like bought a house that was like a murder house, but I don't remember what it was. But he just buys weird shit,
right?
Nothing currently remains of the buildings today other than the concrete foundation, as the entire site was bulldozed down 2 weeks after the siege ended. Only a small chapel built years later stands on the site. The events that happened at Waco spurred criminal prosecution and civil litigation. A grand jury charged 12 of the survivors from the siege with aiding and abetting in murder of federal officers, as well as unlawful possession and use of various firearms. That kind of feels like they couldn't get David Koresh, so they just, like, did the people who got released.
Yeah, they were like, we think you helped him, so we're going to charge you.
8 Branch Davidians were convicted of firearm charges, 5 convicted of voluntary manslaughter, and 4 were acquitted of all charges altogether. Among those convicted were Kevin Whitecliffe, Jamie Castillo, Paul Gordon Fada, Renos Lenny Avram, Graham Leonard Craddock, Brad Eugene Branch, Livingstone Fagan, Ruth Riddle, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And Catherine Schroeder. By July 2007, all of those convicted had been released from prison.
Honestly, Ruth Riddle is a great name.
That is a really cool name. I like the last name Riddle in general.
Yeah, like, except I want that to be my superhero name.
It also, like, Tom Riddle, Voldemort. It's also a bad last name.
I didn't think of that. I thought of, like, the Riddler from Batman, which is still, like, a villain.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's my super.
So you want to be a Batman villain?
They're kind of cool.
I mean, villains are kind of cooler than superheroes in all of those movies, so I totally get it.
Several people, including the surviving Branch Davidians and family members of those killed or injured in the siege, brought civil suits against the United States government, numerous federal officials, the former governor of Texas, Ann Richards, and members of the Texas Army National Guard. They said that they wanted monetary damages under the Federal Tort Claims Acts, civil rights statutes, the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, and Texas state laws. The bulk of these claims were dismissed by the court as they were insufficient as a matter of law, or because the plaintiffs could give no material evidence. One that had made it through to the Fifth Circuit judge and through a month-long trial was rejected, and they said that the Branch Davidians initiated a gun battle when they fired at federal officers who were attempting to serve lawful warrants and like the FBI returned gunfire in order to protect themselves.
Right.
So they were like, it's not the ATF or the FBI's fault. It's your guys' fault because you shot first. So see.
But yeah. We don't know who actually shot first.
Yeah. But like, that's just what the judge said. Yeah. So there is still a sect of Branch Davidians around. This incarnation is under the leadership of a man named Charles Pace. Charles was actually a follower of Benjamin and Lewis Rodin and was a member of the Branch Davidians since the mid-1970s. And it's called The Branch, The Lord Our Righteousness. It's legally recognized. It is a legally recognized denomination with 12 members. And Charles Pace says that David Koresh twisted the Bible's teachings by fathering more than a dozen children with members' wives. Pace does not claim to be a prophet, but as he claims to be a teacher of righteousness, and that the Lord appointed him and anointed him to be the leader of. So, like, unlike David, who claimed to be a prophet.
Right.
But similar to the Branch Davidians under David Koresh, this sect of the religion is also waiting for the end of times.
But, like, why would you want to follow a religion that the only thing they looked forward to was the end of times?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I'm not religious at all, like, yeah. So I don't know anything. But, like, I feel like most religions are about you living your life and not preparing for death.
Yeah, like being a good person and, like, shit like that. I don't know. It's very strange.
Yeah.
But I love this case. We could have honestly done like two more episodes on it.
Yeah.
So this is a very summarized version, but it's just so interesting. 'Cause
it really is.
Like, really ask yourselves, you guys know the shooting at Waco, Texas, but did you know that it actually ended in a fire 51 days after the shooting?
Yeah, like I just knew, like, Waco, Texas was a thing. Like,
yeah.
I didn't know it was a standoff or a siege or that it revolved around a cult or a religious group or whatever.
Yeah. It's just a really interesting case that I don't think a lot of people know about. And conspiracy theory time, I think it's because the government was in the wrong and they don't like to talk about it.
Okay.
Because why else would everyone know about Waco but not know what actually happened at Waco? Because everyone who I told were covering Waco, they said, oh, that's so cool. And I was like, do you know what happened? None of them knew.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like you also have to be, like, a real specific person to look up what happened at Waco.
I guess, but, like, okay, for example, Vietnam. Do you know anything about the Vietnam War?
No.
Were you taught everything about the Civil War? Yes. And World War One and World War Two? It's because the government doesn't like how Vietnam went. Like, we don't really learn about it, you know? Yeah.
Did you shut your computer before giving us your Florida Man story?
I sure did. Sarah's out here knowing. But yeah, let me give you my Florida Man story because it's actually kind of a good one. Okay. So, Florida man arrested in 35-year-old cold case murder thanks to DNA on a cigarette.
That's very cool.
Detectives in Pensacola said evil won in the unsolved murder of Tonya Etheridge McKinley until today. DNA evidence lifted from a discarded cigarette led Florida police to the man they believe killed a young mother 35 years ago. Tonya Etheridge McKinley, then 23 years old, had just left a New Year's Eve celebration before she was strangled and sexually assaulted in Pensacola, allegedly by Daniel Leonard Wells, who's now 57, according to police. I didn't really know if this arrest would ever happen, the victim's relieved sister, Renee McCall, 62, told NBC News on Thursday. I didn't really think this would happen in my lifetime, not after 35 years. And they basically, like, they had done a search for this a really long time. At the time that she died, she had an 18-month-old son. And they had, like, a little bit of physical evidence and dozens of interviews, but the trail went cold almost immediately.
Okay.
And every couple of years, like, a new lead would pop up and then the case would drop off again. And they basically thought they weren't going to solve this murder. But DNA in a public database eventually linked McKinley's killer to Wells' family and then to him.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I just think is so cool. Like, it I is. Think it's so cool. I know that there are, like, a lot of moral implications with taking DNA from these sites, but it is a public database. So, like, I think we should be allowed to use the evidence that comes from them.
Honestly, because who was it? It was the Grim Sleeper, Lonnie David Franklin Jr., mm-hmm. who was caught by, like, a slice of pizza that he had eaten.
Yeah.
Which is fucking nuts.
It's crazy. Like, it's crazy that when they were collecting DNA, they were like, we're going to wait until we can actually use this DNA.
Instead of use it all up.
And now we can, like, just by your son, by your cousin, be like, you fucking murdered someone.
Yeah, be like, this person is distinctly related to you, or like,
yeah,
is either your father or your uncle. Like, it's fucking nuts. And like, imagine where it's gonna go in another 5 or 10 years.
It's like, insane to think about. I literally can't think about it at all. Like, it instantly my brain fries. It's just so cool. I don't know, it's very fun, very exciting.
I know. And like, I doubt that they still have it in record, but like, when I was a kid, my parents mm-hmm. went and like got me fingerprinted and stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I wonder who has that on record.
If who just like, has little Sarah's fingerprints?
Yeah, like, as an adult, if I go missing, is someone able to use that?
I don't know. Granted,
they can just grab anything in my house and find my fingerprints. Right. But like, it's just so weird.
It is weird. Science is cool, man.
It is.
I wish I understood it. I don't, but it's still cool.
You know, I wish I went through with my biology major. It's fine. I only dropped out of school. It's fine.
You can still do it. I believe in you.
Yeah, maybe in the future when I have money.
Yeah, for sure. But that was this week's episode, guys. We hope that we were able to keep some company with you while you're going crazy inside your own home.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's why we're talking so much, because yeah. we don't have anyone else to talk to.
Yeah.
And like, besides our significant others, but like,
they both work all day.
Yeah. And we also don't like, you know, gossip and talk about work stuff with them.
Yeah.
Which we can with each other.
Yeah.
We're working all day, luckily.
Yeah. Yeah. We're definitely still grateful for all of that. But I'm excited to see how we will come out on the other side of this virus. Maybe I'll be a better person. Who knows?
And hopefully it's sooner than later.
Yes. But stop going out, spreading it around, so we can get out of this sooner rather than later.
And wash your damn hands.
Wash your dang hands. All right, guys. We will see you next week. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya. Remember to give us a 5-star review. Okay, thanks. Love you. Bye.